Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very sweaty afternoon session. Thank you very much for spending your time here when the sun's beating down. It's really nice to have so many people here. My name is Sian Kane. I'm the Deputy Culture Editor for Guardian Australia, and we are gathered here on the lands of the Kaurna people, whose sovereignty was never ceded, and I'm very grateful to be here on their land. I'm from Adelaide. I did a session earlier today, so if you were that, I've probably already flagged my hometown pride, but I'm just so thrilled to be here. It's such a good festival, this one, and thank you very much for being here. I'd like to introduce Ellen van Nerven, who is an award-winning poet and writer behind several books, including Heat and Light, Comfort Food and Throat, a collection that won Book of the Year at the New South Wales Premier Literary Awards in 2021. Their latest book is Personal Score, a collection of writing that takes in their love for sport, specifically soccer or football, if you are, depending on what term you prefer, but also gender identity and sexuality and literature and land and sovereignty and, just so many things. It's such a complex book. There's so much to talk about, so please welcome them. I say this as an endorsement because this is a book about sport. I don't really like sport, and this is a really good book. It's incredibly interesting. So if you haven't read this book, I would suggest, even if you don't like sport, go and get a copy after this, because there's just so much happening in this book and so much sort of big picture thinking that I find as a reader oddly reassuring that there are people out there that are sort of making these links between such big topics that just sort of, you know, it's so nice to have someone come to you with a clarity of thought and go, oh my goodness, like this is incredibly smart. So what we might start with, Ellen, is would you mind reading from an early part of the book, and we'll sort of get a sense of some of the topics that they're writing about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's my cultural obligation to acknowledge Kaurna land and Kaurna people and pay my deepest respects. And I'm really feel very privileged to be here and to be invited to the festival. You know what? This is a really amazing festival, amazing to have, you know, free programming. I want to thank everyone involved in the festival. I also want to thank everyone for turning up on what is a hot day. Hope you're looking after yourselves with water, and it's good that we have the shade here. But I do know that the weather's just going to get hotter this week. So. And also I want to pay respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that are present today, and also acknowledge the more than 46 language groups of South Australia. So I'm going to read a short extract that you have chosen because you believe it might be a good little intro, yeah. A little in into the book. It's called, the chapter that I'm reading from is called I Want to Play. And I start with a quote by Adrienne Marie Brown, one of my favourite writers, that says, what we love makes us whole. What makes us whole is how we survive. I want to play, I say to my parents. It is as close to a demand as it can be, an insistence. No extra words required. I am 11. My brother Ben, 3 years and 3 days younger, has already been a signed registered player for 4 seasons at our local club, Albany Creek. Every day we match each other in the backyard. I attend his games jealously, playing around with a ball on the sidelines, and yes, maybe showboating my juggling a little at halftime in the hope someone might notice. I don't feel like I fit in with the mums who try to coax me away from the field to come sit with them on the deck chairs on the hill to listen to their conversations about things other than football. No thanks. I don't remember when I first kicked a ball. I just do it. The things I can do with a ball, it's always there at foot's length, ready to attach itself to me. The charge I feel between me and the ball is irresistible. More than this, I'm a football academic in training who can watch football on TV all afternoon, who does watch football all afternoon on Sundays with Dad during SBS The World Game specials and Monday night's English Premier League highlights. We fold the washing on the couch and Mum cooks dinner. I know most of the players' names by heart. I have huge posters of Dutch stars, Ruud van Nistelrooy and Dennis Bergkamp on my bedroom walls. And I talk and strategize football all day. When I need to zone out of something unpleasant, in the dentist chair, for example, I recall the formations of Barcelona or Arsenal or Manchester United that I've memorized, starting with the forwards all the way to the back line and the goalkeeper. Little football webs creep over my mind and keep me balanced. Our backyard, a church of football, spilling out into the park outside our house and into the nearby cricket batting net we use as a goal. The protagonist, my bro, Ben, light-footed, tricky, quick. My dad, Wilhelmus Wim, dogged Dutch football fanatic. Me, F, family nickname, two-footed, tries hard. Our dog, Max, always up for piggy in the middle. My mum, Maria, occasional cameo player, though always upstairs to nurse scrapes and injuries, cut up fruit to eat later. Truth is, I never remember being tired. I never remember anything that stopped me playing. I want to play, to actually play beyond the backyard. Is the first desire I have expressed out loud. When I name this desire, it stirs something in me and something in the people around me as well. Reflecting on it much later, I realised growing up AFAB and growing up Indigenous in a racist nation state, I was not meant to have desires that were outside what was expected of me. Everything around me was telling me I needed to know my place. Thank you.
So one of the threads in this book, obviously, is sport. And, you know, even at 11, you have this incredibly, you know, obsessive, you know, you have this deep knowledge of the players, you know, playing with your family. But, you know, even your younger brother, who's, you know, 3 years younger than you, he's playing for a team, and it comes much later for you that you actually announce, I want to play as well.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think, you know, if I came across a kid like you, I'd be going, oh, yeah, this kid must be playing for a team, but it takes you longer to join a team.
Yeah, for sure. And thank you so much for saying that this is a book that you enjoyed despite not being a, you know, massive sports fan, because I did, you know, I wanted to write this book for everyone, and I feel it's not a requirement to love sport, to read this work and engage with it. I think ultimately this book, you know, it's one of its main thematics is desire, which I touched on before, and it, you know, goes beyond, you know, sexual or romantic desire, but, you know, the desire for knowledge, the desire to, yeah, in this case, play soccer or football, play sport, the desire to, you know, to be seen for, you know, who I am, and to, you know, engage in the world. And so I think, you know, I really did think it was, you know, a massive injustice that my brother was allowed to play, but I wasn't. And that's the experience of, you know, a lot of people, a lot of girls and gender nonconforming people who, you know, are told at a young age, no, this sport's not for you. this will be, you know, I think my parents worried that I was going to get hurt playing with the boys. There weren't any girls' teams. So it just wasn't sort of seen as something that was going to happen unless, you know, I really fought for it. So I did really fight for it. And I think, you know, that denies people, you know, the pleasure and the community that sport brings, the well-being. And so, you know, and you see, you know, that sports, you know, definitely in terms of gender equality has really changed a lot in my lifetime, but not enough. You know, from the Matildas being the most popular sporting team in Australia and everyone being behind them, to, you know, only a few years ago, you know, maybe a decade ago, where you couldn't, you know, watch many Matildas games that were televised, and there wasn't the opportunity for people to see themselves represented. Yeah, so, you know, things have changed, but, you know, not enough. And, you know, what's really amazing is seeing, you know, people of all genders, like, wearing Matildas shirts, like, young boys, like, also idolising the players. And, yeah, so I think, yeah, so I sort of start the book there because the book, in a sort of structural way, sort of moves through when I first started playing to when I stopped playing. And so there's a lot of, you know, there's a micro and macro. So there's a lot of sort of macro stuff that I talk about, but it's sort of truncated with, you know, memories of playing and, you know, where I was, and really sort of centred around place. So I grew up in southeast Queensland on Yagara and Turrbal land, and travelling to games, you know, around Brisbane and surrounds, but then also, you know, a bit further, getting on planes for the first time. That was my first real experience of travelling and getting to know where I was and whose land I was on, and sort of history of the place was through playing. So I felt it was really, you know, it felt like a really important way to sort of frame the book. I also really wanted to privilege emotions and what I was feeling at the time and how places can hold emotions, sometimes repressed ones. And yeah, so writing the book took a process of 8 years to find the form that it was, and yeah, really sort of wanted to sort of explore what I could do in, you know, a creative nonfiction form.
I actually have a question about that, because reading it, you go, oh God, there's years of sort of thought that's been brewing in this writer's mind. You can feel it all through the book, and then at the end you make note that you sort of started working on it in 2015, or the first sort of stirrings of it came to you in 2015. And that's quite an interesting experience, I think, because stuff that you're writing 8 years ago, then, you know, when you're wrapping up the book 8 years later, you're going to often be a very different person to who you were when you started the book. And that can be quite a, you write in the book that that's quite a strange experience for you, sometimes a little embarrassing to sort of see your former self on the page.
Yeah, you just know, like, that experience when you, like, read something you've written a long time ago, or you see that old photo, or you see yourself on a video or something, and you kind of, like, cringe a little bit, but it's also about honouring, you know, that journey and that, you know, that past, those past selves that are sort of all add up. And I think that I wanted to really sort of, rather than edit that out, I wanted to sort of show that journey of, you know, like, yeah, sort of figuring things out and honouring that voice and, you know, past experiences and past writing, to sort of create an experience that would span time, and, you know, hopefully sort of be something that was quite, that was like against permanence, against singularity, because I think, you know, we're all plural. We all have multiple selves and multiple parts of ourselves, and we're not the same on every day, like from day to day. So I wanted to sort of write that in. And that also maybe is why I wrote the book. I move in between poetry and prose as well. And there's like different, you know, different types of writing within the book as well.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And so in that extract that you read from before, you know, we've met Ellen, 11-year-old Ellen, that's quite a hard thing to say, that, you know, very driven, clearly knows what they want, and then, you know, eventually does end up playing for a team, but the nearest women's team is quite far away. You know, the resources, the wider resources in society for young girls wanting to play sport, young women wanting to play sport, is just not there in Queensland at that time, certainly. But you excelled. Even though you were diagnosed with dyspraxia and scoliosis, you clearly had this huge personal drive to be really good at this thing that you'd sort of announced that you wanted to do. Is that right? Is that something that you're aware of, sort of this need to do well at sport at a very young age?
It was my language of being able to express myself, was playing. It's funny how the mum and dad didn't want me to play with the boys, because I was playing with the boys every day at school. I was, you know, part of a specific soccer school, and so I was sort of just playing soccer pretty much every day. And so, yeah, we went to Sanford, where I joined my first team, and I describe in this chapter in great detail about getting my first boots. And just how much joy I had, you know, like picking out those boots with Dad and putting them on. And, you know, I played at Sanford, which, for those of you who don't really know, Brisbane is sort of like in the valley. So you have to go over mountain range on turbo land, and is a very sort of farming area. Well, it's changed a lot since I played there, but we did this drive because it was a half an hour drive to the nearest team, and Dad coached our under 12s team, shortly after that I began making representative teams and traveling further away for matches, and so I felt like a really intense pride in being able to play and play well, and I was a striker, so I loved scoring goals, and I loved, you know, running at pace with the ball, and it was just, you know, it's really it was sort of definitely the highlight of my day. And it's sort of really, you know, I talk about in the book about, you know, experiencing, you know, bullying of racist and homophobic and queerphobic kind when I was that age, and how, you know, there was, you know, the on-field incidents and the off-field incidents, but there was something about, you know, playing that had a real sense of defiance to it. You know, I was like, well, I'm going to show you what I can do.
Mm. And that's even within your own team, right? That you were encountering this bullying behaviour from your fellow players, but, you know, the games were chances for you to sort of just show how good you were on the field.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a sad reality that this, you know, exists in sport. And of course, in broader society, and I think it was a really intense time when, you know, I'm going away on these, you know, to you know, in these experiences and sort of having to sort of deal with that and keeping it from my parents as well, because I didn't want them to know that I was having a hard time. I think my mum was really hopeful for me and my brother, you know, like my mum's a strong Malanjali woman and my dad's a Dutch man, and I think she was really hopeful that me and my brother, you know, growing up mixed race, and that that things had, you know, changed a lot since when she was growing up, that we wouldn't experience some of the things that she experienced. So I was really didn't want to tell her about that, or how isolating it was. So yeah, I really just internalized it, and I think yeah, used it as sort of fuel on the field, and also developed a love of writing around that time as well, which is also a way to express myself.
Yeah, yeah. God, it's sad that, you know, even at a young age, you're aware to not tell your mother that, because you know that she has this hope for you. To be aware of that at a young age is so sad. But, and you mentioned as well that your mother notices that you have a on-field personality and an off-field personality,
yeah.
Which is interesting. Could you explain the difference between the two?
Yeah, I think I write in this book about, you know, I was a very shy kid, very quiet. I mean, gotta love our shy people, right? You know, sort of like that sensitivity I now see as like a superpower. And I really, yeah, I think she was like, whoa, like she went and watched me. She's like, whoa, you'll really get in there on the field. So I had this, you know, this, this sort of aggression that was, yeah, a controlled aggression where I loved getting in there, loved tackling, working really hard on the field. And so she was like, whoa, this is like another side of you. I think about it how I think, yeah, sport can be a really great way to sort of have like controlled aggression and like push the body to its limits. And I think just how, from a gender perspective, that can be sort of seen as, a masculine thing, but it's something that everyone can sort of access those sides of themselves. Mm. Yeah.
So from an early age, you know, you're talking to even your own teammates, and even at a very young age, you've got these very young girls turning around to you and saying, I know that because I play this particular sport, I'm perceived as a lesbian, or I am perceived as more masculine than other girls. And there's this sort of heightened kind of desperation to not be seen in those ways, even in amongst young women at, you know, very young age. And you cited actually in a certain point in the book about some Monash University research that was done fairly recently, as it was female athletes that were playing rugby, cricket, soccer and AFLW, I think it was, that 90% of them had said that they were, they believed that they were perceived as a lesbian just because they played that sport, nothing to do with anything else, which is sort of a startling statistic. But do you feel like that's changed? Because obviously, you know, this book covers that you played from 11 to 29, essentially, and you played soccer. Like, did that change? Did that get better? We were talking about the Matildas before.
Mm.
That certainly with their rise, I think that there is a sort of, there is an opportunity there for things, you know, discussing homophobia in sport because, you know, so many of their players are queer and openly so.
Yeah, you know, I talk a little bit about this in the book. You know, I grew up in early 90s, you know, in Queensland. It was very, like, queer-phobic time, you know, and I'm sure even worse earlier years, and I'm sure that sort of environment still exists in some form today. Anything that was seen as being, you know, queer was seen as being bad and negative and, so I think that association of sport, playing sport, being, you know, being queer was something that you know, everyone involved in sport was hyper aware of, which really created a lot of tension, I think, because there was the desire to prove that you weren't queer with some of the straight players, but also, you know, queer people being in that environment feeling like they had to really mask their identity and, you know, really, yeah, really kind of really, it was, yeah, really intense, I think. You know, I played in environments that were really queerphobic, and then I played in environments that were really queer friendly, and there were places where I could find, make friends and feel comfortable. And so there was, you know, this really strong and prevalent, misinformed sort of things where people thought, you know, being queer meant that you were predatory, and that, you know, you were in the changing room to check people out and stuff like that. So that really, it made, you know, young people feel really stressed and really unsafe in those, there's such a sort of casual queerphobia and also overt queerphobia in those places. And so, yeah, growing up sort of thinking about my own identity as queer, non-binary person was something that was really, yeah, really tense, and something that I felt a lot of stress and anxiety and negative feelings towards myself. I think now, you know, you see, and it's only very recently that, say, yeah, we see with the Matildas how we have like our proud out athletes, you know, and we're seen as sort of like role models and like, yeah, just like seen in a really positive light. I think that's actually only very recently. I think it's only very recently that we've had out queer female athletes, you know, from, I think maybe Michelle Heyman might have been the first Matildas player to come out while playing for the Matildas. And so that was very recently, only less, yeah, maybe 10 years ago, or maybe a little bit less than 10 years ago. So we have come a long way, but still we have very few queer male athletes playing at the highest level that are out. So, yeah, it's really, yeah, I think sports, you know, being a space that can be very, you know, exclusive to some, reflects where we are as a society, unfortunately. But there's been, yeah, so much progress that I've been really privileged to witness and yeah, in sport.
Yeah, we do see a lot of far more queer women and non-binary players in the women leagues, certainly for AFL and for soccer and football, but it is startling when you think about then the men's leagues and just the complete absence of, I think we're still at the stage where there is no out English Premier League player playing at the time that they come out. We've still yet to have one, which is astounding.
Yeah, and I believe no out AFL males player. Josh Cavallo, Adelaide boy, came out a few years ago. It's a bit the first player playing at the top level soccer in Australia, and recently Grace Wilson, also Adelaide, came out as the first openly non-binary player of the women's top level, A-League women. So yeah, I think, but yeah, I think those statistics are really shocking in other leagues.
You write also in the book about the difference between how non-binary players of professional sport are regarded to trans players who have undergone surgical transition or any kind of medical transition are regarded at the most professional, the highest paid tiers, that like non-binary athletes can be regarded as woman-light or man-light sometimes in a way that certainly trans women are not afforded. In public debates around things, that there's a lot of scrutiny on trans women in sport.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, there's been really intense, you know, disproportionate political debate around, you know, trans inclusion in sport, and that has a really harmful effect on young queer, trans and gender non-conforming people growing up and thinking about that and thinking, wanting to, you know, play sport but feeling like they can't. And definitely that conversation is really big. I try to sort of capture it in my book, but of course it's much bigger than I could to talk about. You know, I made the choice to specifically talk to a few trans and gender diverse people about their experiences of playing sport. And I think, you know, there's this was great movie that I saw recently, a few months ago, with some friends. My memories sort of Last Girl Wins. Did you see that?
The Taika Waititi.
Yeah, the Taika Waititi movie about the American Samoan team. It's such a good movie. I think my favorite sports movie ever. Because it's about this team that's really bad. Like, they have never won. They've never scored a goal. It really sort of plays with the white savior narrative, because, you know, the white coach being flown in to this, you know, this new place and sort of has to get the team in shape. It really kind of pokes fun of that idea of, you know, an outsider coming in and completely transforming the team, because it's actually the team that transforms the coach. And it's, you know, what it also shows us is really, really quite moving portrayal of gender dysphoria. So one of the, you haven't seen the movie?
I haven't seen, but I know the true story behind this film.
Yeah. Like, and you know, actually, I mentioned her in the book, Jaya, who, you know, playing in the men's team, but identifies as Fafafini, and her experience, you know, feeling dysphoric playing in a men's team, but
Fafafini, would you mind explaining the term?
I think it's specific to Pacifica folk. So I don't necessarily feel like it's like my place to really explain the, you know, deep meaning behind it, but essentially, and I think, you know, this what's interesting about gender and sovereign genders is that you know, colonization has really fucked up the way that we see gender in the Western world. There was always people who identified in different ways as more than one gender, more than two genders. And so, you know, even the term trans might not apply to people that identify as, say, Fafafini or other sovereign genders. So what's really interesting is, sort of seeing Jaya's experience of really experiencing, like, it's captured really well in the movie, that intense feeling, and having to sort of, you know, go off gender affirming hormones to play, and how that sort of makes her feel, you know, like she's not in the right body, and just how that kind of makes her feel. It's really captured very well in the film, and it's such a, you know, core part of the film. Mm. And of course, you know, there's, misgendering that's captured in the film, and that I think a lot of reviewers sort of pointed out that you know, maybe we didn't need to see misgendering, and that I think that's like something that's like a conversation. But what it really sort of shows is, you know, the ignorance and the sort of the idea of, you know, truly understanding who this person is and correcting that misgendering, about just how, you know, how much that can hurt someone, and also hurt the people around them that are witnessing it as well.
I mean, this touches on, you know, I mentioned before that this is like a book of very big ideas. And so, you know, we're talking about sport, we're talking about gender, we're talking about sexuality. But also this, you know, you've got this huge thread of First Nations history running through it. And returning to sport, you know, you write about just how different, you know, the... I guess, like, the purpose of sport is in a lot of First Nation cultures that it's often a tool for social cohesion, which is not necessarily something that you think about when you think of how sport is played in the Western world or in European cultures, that it would be something that would promote social bonds. It almost seems like something that would break social bonds a lot of the time. Would you mind sort of talking a little bit about that?
Yeah, I talk, like, really about just, like, how... Like, for us as mob, like, sport just has such transformative power. And there's been so much, you know, sort of self-determined organisation around sports, you know, from Koori Knockout to, you know, Murray Carnival to, you know, all these kind of Indigenous... led sporting carnivals that that go beyond just sport, but they're really celebration and gathering, and, you know, about culture, about health, about family, which, you know, really touches on such a long trajectory of us, you know, continuing, you know, practicing this for, you know, thousands of years. So. Sport, you know, there's not actually a direct Indigenous words that actually describe sport in a Western terms, but certainly there's words like Mugulan and Bunjalung to play. But sport was very much and is very much seen as being very cohesive with so many other aspects of life, and so. Yeah, so when I sort of talk about that and I talk about, this continuance going from sort of talking about traditional sports and traditional games, many that are still played on this continent, through to thinking about what sports means for mob today, and how sometimes that's not how... Western frame sees sport.
So, like, a lot of it's, like, non-competitive, essentially.
Yeah, lots of games are, like, non-competitive, very, like, holistic, thinking, you know, very much like was what I write a lot about in the book about connection to country. So, you know, not thinking about we're going to, you know, basically destroy this, we're going to, you know, clear these trees, or we're going to pollute the water, or we're going to, you know, put these lines down, or, you know, not thinking about, you know, destroying country, but thinking about how, you know, we can play and be on country while looking after country. And a lot of games are very circular and are not really about those... really defined lines and boundaries and borders.
Would you mind talking about a couple? Because you list a few in the book. Weme, I think, is how it's pronounced.
Yeah, this game, you know, still is active in, let me find a page reference, in Central Australia, which is a stone bowling game. So in Eastern Arunda language, Weme refers to throwing something at something else and hitting it. it's sort of kind of marble throwing game. I think, well, what I talk about this is, you know, how many games we have that resemble our codes of football. People will definitely know about Mangrook, but I talk about, you know, round ball versions as well. So it comes to mind, you know, who really invented football? I think there's a lot of sports that are played in, say, you know, places like Asia as well that, you know, also resemble football. Really thinking about, sort of long histories around sport and play. There's, you know, some specific Torres Strait Islander games. Kokan, which is a game that's similar to hockey, and Edo, which is a sort of like a running game. You can see being, you know, played in Torres Strait and also North Queensland. It's a chasing and tagging game with a large group. Possibly you can see this played on the beach. What I wanted to sort of just show is just how broad this continent is, and just, you know, really just see sport as not something that was imported from Europe and brought here, but something that is very much in the fabric of this land.
And I mean, this is not an Indigenous sport, but I just thought it was such an interesting example. I'd never heard of vigoro. I think I'm saying that right. Which is a sport that was invented in 1900 by a man who thought that tennis wasn't masculine enough. So he made a new sport.
Yeah.
But oddly enough, women in Queensland really took to it, and now it's mostly played by women in Queensland.
Yeah. To be honest, I don't know much about vigoro, but I'll have to ask some mob at Cherbourg to talk about it. It's very, you know, popular in Cherbourg. Some of those, because I think my mum grew up playing it, so some of those sports are just really interesting sort of history capsules to sort of think about the way that sport, like tennis not being masculine, so we'll create this sport that actually, you know, women will really take it up. See how sport has evolved in mainstream culture about sort of what we see as being popular, what we see as, you know, certain people being, attracted to playing. I find that history really, really interesting, how those conditions, for example, on Manjiraba, which is close to where I live, acknowledge the Quandamooka people, there's a mission on Manjiraba, and it also was a place where they had one of Queensland's first asylums. And actually, there was cricket matches that were organised between the Aboriginal people on the mission and the people in the asylum. And so, Quandamooka mob got really, particularly with women, got really good at cricket. And Udra Newknuckle was one of those women that were really, really deadly at cricket. So it's interesting how those sort of histories happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's also this gendered role in how these sports are developed. That you think of netball as well, which is sort of thing that a lot of young women are encouraged to play, often as a sort of, I guess there's less contact potential than basketball.
Yeah, you think, oh, play netball, it's a safer sport, but the rate of ACLs in that sport, like...
Number of times I was punched in the stomach by other girls.
And the nails, oh my God.
Way more dangerous.
It's really interesting to see those perceptions of safety and how they kind of come about in sport.
Yeah. But also that you think of netball now, like a lot of people that I know play netball play in mixed divisions, like obviously not professionally, but that there are a lot of men playing netball
now.
And like this sport that perhaps even in our own lifetimes was seen as like a very feminine thing that only girls played. Now loads of men enjoy playing it, which is just it's an interesting dimension of sport that there is this fluidity that is, as long as you love it, you can kind of make it your own thing.
I love how all those boundaries are being disrupted and we can go beyond seeing certain sports as being masculine or feminine or for particularly groups of people and, you know, opening things up.
Yeah. Mm. And so another really big part of this book as well is place and land. And you mentioned before about as you were playing for these really successful soccer teams, so you were, you know, flying around, quite a lot of Queensland and playing games and seeing a lot of Queensland and getting a sense of, I guess, you know, where your people are from, where your family's from. But also this... it's a nationwide story as well, but also one in Queensland where, you know, you'd be on these these tours for sports and come across names like Murdering Creek, for instance, and, you know, these place names that have got, you know, incredibly awful racist histories behind them that are still there as when you're a young person on tour. Could you speak to, I guess, because you mentioned in the book that there are often incidents where you were, you know, you would be on tour with the team and you'd have this sense that other players were looking at you, you know, when you'd come across these places.
Yeah, you just know when you're in a place and you just feel that something bad happened there, and you just feel, you know, it changes how you feel in your body, right? Like, I think, yeah, from a young age, I had a real sensitivity to place and thinking about where I was and what happened, and having this, you know, really big Murray family, so feeling a real connection to the place that I lived. And but whenever I moved away, I was very curious to know where I was and whose country I was on. You mentioned those names. I think maybe Queensland might be the worst, or has been the worst, for having, you know, just how many names that, you know, might reference, either names that reference massacres or violence against Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people, or names that have, you know, racist terms in them. So there's many place names in Queensland. I think that, you know, that it's definitely some of these names have been changed, but have the N-word in them. And just how, you know, violent that is, but also obviously speaks to a history. You know, the past is in the present. So I talk about in the book, I also talk about Stephen Hagen's long fight to remove the N-word from a stadium in Toowoomba, which is a really important part of recent history. I really recommend that you read up about Stephen Hagen, and also he wrote a book about it. Just sort of how it speaks to attitudes that, racist attitudes that still exist today. There's also names in where I live in Brisbane that refer to places where, Aboriginal people weren't allowed to enter. So in Brisbane, you know, there was a grid where, you know, there was a curfew, and so mob were allowed to, you know, on what always was and always will be Aboriginal land, during, this era in Queensland. There was Boundary Street West End, Boundary Street Spring Hill, Wellington Road in East Brisbane, and then, and, you know, another boundary on the west. So people were allowed to go into that area, into the city, to work, but then after 5 p.m., 6 p.m., they, you know, had to leave. So there was, you know, that segregation, and people were, assaulted by police or thrown in jail if they didn't leave. There's debate around those place names, around, say, Boundary Street in West End. Should we rename that street name? So you'll have people that will do graffiti, and they'll be like Boundless Street. But there's a lot of people who have living memories of that, you know, that violence and that exclusion, that say, no, we want to keep the name Boundary Street because it will be able to educate the future generations of what happened here, and we won't throw it under the rug. So there's a range of different place names. I think Yeah, there's absolutely a really strong case for racist names to be changed. Like, it's undeniable. Mm. But there's, you know, there's names like Boundary Street that have a stronger debate.
Mm.
And as you mentioned, you know, I talk about my education and my engagement with place and, you know, what it was like sometimes to be, you know, the only Aboriginal person within a travelling group and, you know, experiencing those emotions and those questions.
Mm, yeah, because, like, obviously a very formative time for you, and then, you know, it's another intersection in this book about between land and sport as well, that you talk about the history of how a lot of meeting places that were really, you know, significant and important to different Aboriginal nations and Torres Strait Islander nations were then turned into ovals, which were then turned into stadiums, and that you can often see a correlation between the placement of a place in Australia where, you know, people play sport today that were significant places for the Aboriginal nation and the people that lived there.
Yeah, for sure. So what happened is when white fellas wanted to sort of start making their sporting fields, they chose places that were already cleared. So they were cleared by a mob for ceremony, for camp and for sport. So, you know, like I said, talking about an inclusive sort of space site where that multiple things are happening and there's a reason why that place is where it is. You'll have, you know, even very high profile stadiums like the MCG and the Gabba in Brisbane have a really strong really strong cultural sites. And some of those sites, you know, you'll still have like scar trees and sort of evidence of, you know, what their purpose was. And then, you know, the sad reality is that mob were removed from those places, sometimes killed, and that access to be able to, you know, go to that place is stopped. But maybe there's also a slight sort of silver lining in that really what is a really horrible colonization, in that those places are still being used for what they have been for thousands of years, and mob can still play sport, but it's conditional. So you can play, you can be there, but it's conditional to, you know, an organized sport. So yeah, so we talk, I think, and me and my family and my friends, we talk a lot about continuance and remembering, you know, that's happens on a body level as well.
Yeah. And so, like, this is sort of an example of just sort of the big thinking that you're doing in this book. You know, you're traversing, we're talking about racism, we're talking about sport, we are talking about land, and they are all conversations that are happening at the exact same time, that there is you know, these are not separate topics. These are all one story in this book. I guess, you know, I would love to know, you know, so you quit football, you quit playing soccer at the age of 29, which was, you know, fairly recently. And you write in the book that you miss the old me. You miss the person with the football at their feet.
Yeah.
I wonder, do you still feel that way? You know, it's been a few years, I guess, now since. Like, has your relationship with your body, with sport, changed?
Yeah, anyone who's used to play something will know that feeling. I think it doesn't necessarily leave you. It's like kind of that itch, you know, when you sort of see a ball being kicked around, or even just, you know, going for a walk. I walk a lot these days, and just smelling, you know, the cut grass or something. I think actually because I watch a lot of sport on TV, but there's something about being that physically, like me and a colleague, we went to see the Women's Roar play Melbourne City on the weekend and at Perry Park, and just actually, I was getting a lot of the physical sensations. Mm. You know, it's the smell of the chips of the canteen, the whistle, the people that are there. And, you know, and this was a venue that I'd played in a few times, so I was feeling a very physical memory that made me really miss playing. And, you know, I think, you know, I experienced, you know, because I had this injury that's basically stopped me playing, and I would, for several years, I would, you know, strap everything up and, you know, spend probably longer than the actual game to get ready to try and kind of hobble onto the field and have a whole ritual after. I think there was sort of a negative, you know, association with doing that and with playing and putting my body through that, that I actually just realised the other day, well, actually, when I think about the body and think about my body and think about playing, I feel most myself when I'm playing. So that was a really interesting sort of revelation. I feel most affirmed in my gender. I feel most affirmed in who I am when, you know, I have a ball at my feet. And that was a discovery that sort of happened after writing the book, which is really interesting. We were talking a little bit about the journey that you know, and your relationship to the book. You know, this book has been out for a while now. This came out around the World Cup, Women's World Cup, last year. And it's about to come out in America in a couple of weeks. And so I had to sort of look at it again and sort of confront, I guess that's the right word, confront that, you know, those personal stories and, you know, that writing and just how, we can sort of feel. And then, you know, of course, getting people who have read it sort of telling me bits that they liked and what their stories and things, just how expansive that journey of writing a book can be and how there's no real finish line, to use a sports metaphor. That sort of kind of lives on and changes.
Yeah. Well, you write in the book towards the end about, I guess, what can be learned from different First Nation cultures' approaches to sport, and you have a sort of little guide at the end, which I really enjoyed reading. But it's so nice to, so one of them's just like, be kind, which is sort of something perhaps you don't think of when you think about competitive sport, but how that is actually a crucial element of, you know, playing sport and games in Indigenous cultures, that there is this absence of a huge competitive drive at all costs.
Yeah, we should all be kind to ourselves and to ourselves and to other people. I really am still learning how to be kind to myself. And I think, you know, what I sort of refer to is, you know, there's a real unfortunate sort of teaching that sort of happens at a young age that is potentially around humiliating other people. Like, so you'll sort of like see, you know, young kids playing and the adults will be like, smash him, get him, like, or like this real level, and like, you know, encouraging people to sort of play dirty, or, you know, that is, I know I talked about being aggressive as not necessarily a bad thing, but there's aggression is a normal part of sport, but then you can really sort of go into something that's, like I said, it's about, you know, being dirty, it's about humiliating, it's about shaming, it's, it can really cause a lot of harm. And so, yeah, sort of thinking this sort of winning at all costs mentality that can really have, you know, negative effects on people when they might just be wanting to, you know, grow up and play sport and be with their friends. So, yeah, I talk about that in the book, and the chapter that you mentioned is sort of like the last chapter of the book, and it's a little bit cheesy, but it really has struck a nerve with people who have read it. And so it's just like a little a guide that sort of covers a lot of ground, which is how to play sport on Indigenous land, and sort of goes through, sort of values that I feel really passionate about and sort of how we think about sport in this country.
Well, I think that's a really nice note to end on. Mm. Be kind, everyone. Please support all the authors at Adelaide Writers Week this year, and head over to the book tent and buy their books. I hope my endorsement that I'm not a sports person and I really liked this book about sport is somewhat convincing to get you over there to buy Ellen's book. There will be a book signing at the end of this session, so if you want to go talk Ellen's ears off about sport, which I'm sure a lot of you do, please do. Please join me in thanking Ellen.
Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Hope you have a lovely day. And thank you so much for being such a generous conversationalist. Thank you.